What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Pod Monster. I'm your host, Philip Good. As always, if you like what you hear, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from, or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at TheFilipGood. But before we get started, this episode of the podcast is sponsored by Downright.com. Downright has hundreds of your favorite talented songwriters ready to create a one-of-a-kind song for any occasion. A couple of examples are a first dance at a wedding, a special anniversary, a birthday jam, or just because you would deserve your own theme song. The possibilities are basically endless. Visit Downright.com and use offer code PODMONSTER to get a few bucks off your first commission. That's DOWNWRITE.com. We're also sponsored by Passion House Coffee Roasters. Passion House is a lifestyle brand that's continually pushing the limits. They are all about connecting and connecting people through the beautiful little seed we call coffee. They take coffee seriously so you don't have to, because Passion House sources the best coffees from growers who are consciously growing, harvesting, and processing coffees with earth and people in mind. Get yours today at www.passionhousecoffee.com and get 15% off your order with code PODMONSTER, or feel good at their Logan Square location right across the street from the Blue Line. That's www.passionhousecoffee.com. Our guest today is stand-up comedian Clark Jones. Now, Clark has been making his rounds throughout the U.S. doing comedy. He started in Chicago, moved out to New York, did the New York comedy scene, and has recently moved out to L.A. to try to take over that comedy scene. You can find his stand-up comedy album on Spotify, Instagram, wherever you get your music and albums from. It's called First of All. But anyway, for now, give it up for Clark, and welcome to one of those things. So ever since then, I just started doing different things. I've done open mics still, but it's not one of those things. You, however, you know, what made you start with comedy, man? What you know, I know you're from Chicago,
yeah.
But what made that spark?
Oh, comedy is just, it's a big part of, I think, growing up here. And a big part of, I don't know what it is about the Midwest. Like, it's a lot of funny people out of Cleveland, mm-hmm. Parts of Indiana, Wisconsin. It's just the Midwest is known for just like kind of having that chip on its big shoulders, if you will.
Because we're always so goddamn cold and we're wanting to.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, this chip with the, we're not New York or L.A. and, you know, kind of like having to try to circumvent like not being on the coast, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a part of, you know, insecurity, you fight and you're loud and you want to be heard and you want to have a voice. So I think that's why a lot of comedians come out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I have a funny family. So okay. Like my family really was where it was. The seed was planted. And, I don't know. Like, I always looked up to it. I didn't know about being a stand-up because I thought, I didn't know about a process. Yeah. I thought, like, oh, everybody who I saw on TV just had an hour of comedy. I don't know how it was developed, how it came about. Open mics, I didn't know none of that shit.
Yeah.
So, I had a friend who started, my boy Will Miles, who I've known for over 20 years. He kind of showed me there's an entryway into it, you know. All I know was Alter Street and then on HBO, whatever.
Yeah.
So he kind of showed me that that was an entry point or entry point, an entryway. And I just started there at Town Hall Pub running a show with him. And, you know, I think like maybe that was 2008 maybe. But 2009 is when I like tried to start getting booked on things.
Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between like people hanging out and being like, you know, oh, we're funny and all that stuff, we should do stand-up comedy, versus like you said, the process.
Yeah.
When did you start developing that process? Like when I mentioned that I started stand-up comedy, it was because buddies of mine from Chicago called the Walker Twins. They're twins, stand-up comedians, and we all work together, and they're like, oh, we should do stand-up comedy. And in that moment, I was like, you know, there's a big difference. You know, we might talk shit here.
Oh, absolutely. That's what, I mean, that's the biggest thing that people say first. Like, oh, I'm so funny around my friends.
No.
You don't understand, like, they know you, ironically, like, after a certain point, when people have heard your albums or they've seen you on TV or whatever, or they, you know, follow you on Instagram, Twitter, whatever, then it kind of becomes that, where they know your voice and stuff like that. So later on, the world becomes your friends.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, you're introducing yourself. It's like, yeah, sitting down at a group, a table full of people, and then you immediately go to all these inside jokes, and you're just like, wait a minute, why aren't y'all laughing?
Yeah.
Because they don't know.
Exactly.
So, like, maybe an hour in or 10 years into the brunch, then they start to know who you are. You
yeah.
know? And you know who you are and what you want to say.
Definitely. One of the biggest things that, like, I feel, and I want your take on this, when you first started doing comedy, I'm assuming the same experience happened to you that happens to a lot of comedians when you do that first open mic and you're over here like, okay, either nervous or excited about your what you've come up with, and then you start saying the jokes, and from my experience, no one's looking at you because it's other comedians, essentially.
It was a trap for me because my first set went well, but okay. My first set was in a very comfortable place.
I got the same experience, but keep going.
So like, the first set I did was the show that ended up co-hosting two black dudes in open mic. It was called Kid Ha Ha's Playhouse at first.
Nice.
For one show. Mm-hmm. I performed on it, and then after that, we started co-hosting it. And also, it was just like, I'm more comfortable on stage than off stage, so I never had the nerves of, oh, this is a big deal type thing. I had a job. I wasn't really, I just wasn't nervous about it. So that was the trap of it. And then, you know, 2009, like I said, that following 6 months after, I started trying to get booked on shows. And that was when, you know, you realized the business of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I ever did stand up, I take that back, it was at Jokes and Notes. The host was Lil Rel from Get Out.
Okay.
He was the first person to ever bring me on stage as a comedian.
That's awesome.
And that went fine, too. It also was like, it may have been worse than I remember it. I just remember not really caring. I was just happy to be up there.
Hell yeah.
And that was the victory for me.
It's funny you mentioned Jokes and Notes. I think it closed down officially. My buddies in the Walker Twins wanted to take me up.
Okay.
They wanted to have me come up there. And the line started, you know, forming up for people to go up. But there's, like, you know how it is. Like you said, the business.
Mm-hmm.
The line may be here, but the line technically comes, oh, hey, what's up? Yeah, we'll get you five, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I was first in line. The guy says, we'll see if we have time for you.
Okay.
To me. And they were pissed. The Walker Twins were pissed. But I'm like, no, this makes sense. It's fine. So it was one of those interesting experiences where, like,
Did you go up?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but yeah. They were mad, and then it's
everybody
mm-hmm.
kind of goes through that hazing.
But yeah. But it's interesting that, like, that used to be, like you said, Lil Rel was up there.
And Lil Rel used to host the Wednesday night open mic. Open mic, I put in air quotes, because people were paying, and it was packed.
Yeah.
So people were paying, you know, she's going to put up a few guaranteed funny people.
Yeah.
Or some people that people are there to see, and that balances out. If you're a new person and you go up and you bomb, it's like, oh, that's a part of the process. You bomb, then she brings up somebody who knows what they're doing.
Exactly. As opposed to the opposite, which they told me as well, was that one night they were going up at Jokes and Notes, and they were getting ready to go, and then they get bumped. They go, hey, we're just going to put one guy in front of you. Okay, cool. It's Hannibal Buress.
Oh.
Goes up right in front of him, and he goes, Phil, he murdered.
Mm.
He murdered. And then I got to go up after that.
What year was this, you know? How long ago was this?
I'm trying to think. Hold on. 13 or 14?
Oh, okay.
So.
Okay.
I'm going to say, yeah, I'm confident with that date. But that was just, I can only imagine. Like, have you ever had that where you're in your early days where someone came up and you had to follow that?
Not there, but it's happened
in general.
At other shows before. Yeah. Black audiences, whatever. The thing is, what I got into and what I started to develop was just like, okay, I'm going to say something different as I got into, because I couldn't talk about the same subjects that may have just killed. You know what I mean? Like, as you refine your shit, you just like, it don't matter and this happened recently.
Okay.
Where I was just in this zone where it's like, it don't matter how hard somebody kills in front of me. Mm-hmm. Because even if they touch the subjects, I know I'm talking about some shit that's so specific to me. Mm-hmm. Unless they're doing my jokes specifically.
Yeah. Then we got to fuck them up.
Then, right. Then we got a problem. Then I was just like, whatever, we'll have that conversation. But,
yeah.
You know, in the beginning, I always would talk about something different. I just didn't know how to tell jokes that well. So, yeah, mm-hmm. it's happened all the time. And they can be, it's weird at a show when people aren't doing the same amounts of times because the audience has a certain
attention span.
Attention span, but like scientifically, in their brains, a person is supposed to be doing this long. Mm-hmm. That's why everybody should do 8 minutes until mm-hmm. the headliner. Somebody yeah. doing 13, somebody doing 3, somebody doing 5. Like, the person doing 13, they kill for 13. So when you coming out and you only doing 3, they want it right away.
Bang, yeah.
They want it. Black crowds, the first thing that you say is when your set starts.
Mm-hmm.
Some white crowds, your set starts midway around the second or third joke. That's when you start to get mm-hmm. judged about whether you're funny or not.
That's actually very interesting that you say that, the difference between the black crowd and the white crowd, because my first show, kind of like you were saying, you were kind of put in a good situation, right, in your first show.
Right.
Mine was too, but it was to a black crowd.
Okay.
And I did very well. My jokes transitioned very well for them. Mm-hmm. And at Zany's, that was a white crowd. And I bombed. And it was very interesting.
It's a whole different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether people pay. But even then, even black crowds aren't homogenous, because the black crowd, $5 Wednesday crowd, is different than the all black crowd on the weekend. They pay $20 to drink minimum and probably on dates. They are in the mindset of, this is a comedy club.
Be funny.
It was just like, they are more accepting of, okay, they're going to be up there for about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
We can be a little bit more patient. And on a Wednesday, it's like, everybody's supposed to be doing 3 unless we know that they're funny. Mm-hmm. So we like, it's almost like the Apollo, where it's like, yo, come out banging.
Yeah.
It's Gladiator.
Yeah. Yeah. Kill or be killed, man.
Yeah. Just come out. You got to come out on fire.
When you're up there, and obviously as you've come up and grown your craft, have you found yourself to be the guy that sticks to your material, or are you also comfortable just winging it?
I mean, it's like jazz. So jazz isn't jazz unless there's some improvised part,
mm-hmm.
by definition.
Yeah,
and that's how I look at comedy. A good set, I've improvised something.
Yeah.
Whether it's off a joke, I mean, I'll stick to my material, but a quick crowd work, something has to be special for that crowd, even if it's 1-5 second, whatever. So, you know, I believe in my material. I can go up and do my material if they, and it's a lot of, now it's a lot of like theme shows, like do your material or cracking these eggs or whatever it might be. Yeah. It's a lot of different things. So I like improv a lot, mm-hmm. so I just kind of roll with the punches.
That's good.
You know, hit or miss.
Have you, I feel like a lot of them come out of, obviously, hecklers would be one of the big thing, right, to get that preparation going sometimes.
Yeah, I had a lot of hecklers in the beginning. I think working jokes and notes helped me come out firing.
Mm.
I like to just get straight into, you know, that first thing. I've just been trained in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I did a Domino Sugar comedy competition. Mm. I had on a bow tie. I still got the photos from that.
Oh, shit.
The lady stood up and told me, you are not funny. I would say unprompted, but maybe my jokes prompted her. But that was so, I was so caught off guard by that because it was my first heckler.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also hosted shows where I've shut down hecklers. Mm-hmm. And there was one show in Hyde Park, Chicago, where I was making, it was a music showcase, all rappers. I'm hosting it. And you know, you make fun of the rappers or whatever. One dude was like, yeah, man, I was going to beat your ass, but you was funny. So I'll give you a pass this time. I'm like, all right, I guess. Like, thanks. You know what I mean?
That's ridiculous.
So hecklers come in all different types of ways. I try to talk louder than mm-hmm. the heckler.
Yeah.
And they have to be really doing something for me to get off, because I feel like the jokes that I'm trying to tell are worth hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always trying to fight to tell the jokes. But if they, you know, if they can't help themselves, then they get addressed.
Oh, of course. Have you ever, I feel like I mention this a lot, but it's one of my favorite movies. Have you ever seen the movie The Heckler?
No.
See, I feel like I mentioned this a lot on this podcast.
Oh, was that Jamie?
It's like a documentary, but it follows him a lot because unfortunately for him, he gets it probably a lot. And in the documentary, he did. They really kind of like made it seem like he was the guy.
I don't think he fights to try to tell material, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he almost welcomes it. There's mm-hmm. this thing with just going up with nothing and trying to, you know, come up with it on the spot or right on stage, as they say. And
yeah.
That's cool for some people, but everybody wants that gift, but everybody don't have that gift.
Yeah, no, of course.
So but that's when people they're gonna try to get their money's worth by being involved in the show.
Yeah, and the movie, like I said, if you haven't seen the full thing, it breaks down kind of like the psychology aspect of, like you were saying, you try to speak louder to stop, you know, that interruption from coming in, but the psychology portion is, it's not just you, right? Because once there's noise in the room, the audience notices it too, and they break down kind of where if there's noise, the audience at that moment has that attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
comedy audiences are very insecure as a group in that people get nervous to laugh if nobody else is laughing.
Yeah, definitely.
Or they'll laugh silently. It just happened at a show I was doing in L.A. where a comic came up to me after. He was like, oh, man, we had to cover our mouths. I'm like, why? Because I guess it's not cool for comedians to laugh at another comedian or whatever. Or, like, you know, part of it is like, I don't want to interrupt what you're trying to do because we use so many different tool belt accessories or whatever. So I guess they don't want that. But it's just like, it's so weird. People don't want to be caught laughing at something other people aren't laughing at. Or if somebody has the attention, then, yeah, their attention goes there. It's like you're just really trying to get the audience all on one page, laughing when they're supposed to, and being on your side.
Definitely. Do you find it more difficult to host, or is it more difficult to just be like one of the features?
It's a different pitch, you know, like it is a way to ease your jokes in, you know. When I'm hosting, it doesn't matter what I'm doing as long as I'm comfortable. If I'm uncomfortable, my mind is someplace else, then I overthink it. But you never know what you're gonna get. Like if I'm just comfortable and happy to be there and I'm fine like that, then I don't even think about it. Because I could do a whole crowd work thing and have a conversation, and then when that tapers off, put some jokes in there or steer what seems like a just, you know, on the spot conversation, steer it towards a joke that I'm trying to tell.
Because I feel like a host would probably be more involved with the control of the audience, kind of like a ringmaster.
Oh, for sure. You know what I mean? You have to corral them.
Yeah. And with that, like, that's where that improv comes in a little bit more, I think, when it hosting. But it also develops your skill to be able to host as well as just go up there.
Yeah, like, you got to listen to people off stage as a comedian who goes on stage. Because if you're doing all the talking and you're always on, sure, that's when it gets into like the art of comedy. I look at comedy more as an art science.
That's good.
So, you know, some comedians, they're just naturals.
Yeah.
At whatever. And they can do that, the art side of it, where it's just like, I don't know what he's talking about. Some people bomb gracefully, whatever. But I listen a lot off stage, and then I put it back out when I get on stage.
That's good.
So some things in there, I don't even know they're there. But I just picked it up from a conversation, and I'm able to, I see somebody, and something triggers where I can relate back to a conversation I had. So, because you look like this other person, or you say this one thing, and that's based on a conversation I was having before. So really, when the lights come on, I kind of black out, man, to be honest, and just kind of let the stage take over.
That's good.
Try not to overthink it.
No, that's very good, because you got this calmness that, like I said, everyone's different and everyone goes up on stage a little differently. Some might have that pre-show adrenaline. Some might just come up there and just light switch goes on and then just does the work, you know?
The more you write, the more you have. So
definitely.
Always write. Always write shit down. Even if it's just a thought, anything that makes you laugh, write it.
You have a big thing in journalism, obviously, when it comes to writing. What made the trip to New York? You know, obviously, we talked about it before that you're not there anymore, but what made the initial trip? Was it to pursue more stand-up, or was it to pursue more writing?
Stand-up.
Yeah.
It was pure stand-up. I went with two of my closest friends, Kenny DeForest and Will Miles, and we just hopped in a U-Haul and was like, all right. I never wanted to be the top dog in Chicago. Mm. That was never really my goal. That's not to knock it at all. It was just like I had been paid to perform at every Chicago comedy club. And that was my goal, to just at least be past everywhere.
Just knock out the venues?
Yeah, Improv, Up, Zanies, Jokes and Notes, the one out in the South Suburbs, I forget the name. But everywhere, I had did every show and got paid to do every show. That's not just guess, like paid to do it. And that was when I was like, all right, cool. And then I was ready to bounce.
Nice. In New York, was it? So you went there primarily for stand-up. What did you expect? I know you kind of, when we talked earlier, you mentioned, you know, you just kind of go with it, wing it, right? But did you have any expectations?
I just wanted to learn a lot. I was hoping to get a few things that didn't pan out, but some things that I didn't know I would get. I got on Crashing. I got on, I'm on Stars, Wyatt's and X, Night Train, which I didn't even, going in, I didn't even know that was a thing that was possible. Mm-hmm. So anything that I expect rarely happens. So I try not to have expectations at all. Yeah. And that's not like just a throwaway thing. I'm saying like literally anything that I set my mind to doesn't happen. So I try to stop. I just try to write and perform on shows and wait till I actually see it. Like see me myself in that position to say, oh, that happened. So cool. But like anything that I think about too hard, it just doesn't happen for some reason.
I used to get that exact same thing as a kid when I wanted like a video game or something was coming out, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna get it, and I get there and it's sold out.
Something finds itself as a hurdle to the thing that you were just sure was gonna happen.
Yeah.
And I wish, you know, all this like, oh, if you gotta speak it into existence, I think that's bullshit. It don't work for everybody. I just try to do what works for me.
No, it's good, because if you develop, it's not just thick skin, but it's just this like baseline mentality. You know, there's no like excite. Like, you know, if you get super excited about something, the letdown's even worse.
People guarantee you things, and then it don't happen.
Oh, especially in the industry.
Especially.
Oh my god.
Guarantee, because they just want to see that hope on your face and that and then something happens or whatever. You know.
Yeah.
Like I've gotten plenty of last minute cancellations on things.
Yeah.
It's just what it is, man.
I was going to do a documentary, and I have a lot of footage still. I filmed with Steve Byrne, and I filmed with, like, Alonzo Bowden at the Improv. And it was
I opened for him once.
What was it?
I opened for him once. Yeah.
Nice. He's a cool guy. He's very direct.
Very meticulous about his process and should be. And
the one thing I asked them was, because it's interesting that you went to New York and now you're about to go to L.A. They told me, well, Steve Byrne told me, for example, is that New York is the breeding ground for kind of tougher comedy as opposed to Los Angeles. Because in New York, that's his opinion. You know, he could be wrong. But in New York, he said that it's like you can do really crude comedy and it would go over a lot easier than it would in L.A. Do you think you've been everywhere, right? What would you say that's agreeable?
I can't speak directly for LA, but out there you still can do characters.
From your experiences, I'd say.
In LA you still can do characters. You can do, it's a lot of everybody's going up. I think New York is a little bit more gatekeeperish about who's going up.
Yeah.
In LA, like
That's why I heard more open arm in LA.
It's just like there's no, you can't go up in Los Angeles. You know, there's still opportunity if you're good to kind of rise to the top. There's a lot, like, there's a million people with, not a million, but damn near people with a great 15 minutes in New York. I think there's a lot of people in LA with a great 3 minutes or an hour.
Yeah.
So, like, it's the inverse in that way. So people work towards that 10 or that 15 in New York so they can get a late night spot or to get on certain shows or just as a tape to have. Los Angeles is just a different, it's like, it's just the, yeah, just the inverse is different. I also think Steve Byrne may be talking about maybe the way things were. I think New York leans on its reputation as like, yeah, this week become a great stand up. But everybody is succumbing to this idea of social media stars, New York included, LA included, where places you weren't respected, like, yeah, I'm going to go here and I know I'm going to see some great stand up. Not necessarily. You go there, you see people who are there because of who they know or how many Instagram followers they have.
That's true. That's true. It's changed that way too. Like now,
for sure, places got to stay in business.
But the problem is that, like, I think in New York, especially if someone, you know, is doing these YouTube skits or these whatever Instagram skits, and then they get on stage, I just don't think they cut it. I think it's a different type of.
They don't, but they already got your money at that point.
That's true. That is true.
You're already there. So it's not like, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, this person wasn't as funny. Here's your money. No. They go, you're already there. And then people will come back to see. It's so many people who've never been to a comedy show before. I didn't realize that till I got into it. I had maybe been to one. But I was just like, I already know funny people. I don't know why I would pay to see stand up. That was just my mentality. But it's a lot of people never been, so you get a lot of first timers, and they're like, oh, there's that person from Instagram. It's like, oh, that wasn't that funny, but, you know, it's too late.
You paid.
You already paid.
Yeah, he's out the door. With what you did recently, I think last year, right, you did your special.
First album.
Yeah. Congratulations
Thank
on that,
Thank you
by the
so
way.
Much. Yeah.
How did you feel about it?
I wasn't sure. It was my first one at first. It was a very humbling and like vulnerable experience because I had put on you only get one first one. You pretty much spent your whole life making your first album. So I had jokes in there. It was 5 years old, 6 years old, whatever. But the good thing was, older jokes had went through this filter of how I tell jokes now.
Yeah, you reconstructed.
So, yeah, it was just like, and you also have to think about where you are. I recorded it in Brooklyn. So that would be different than when I used to tell that joke in Ohio, you know, in 2010. But I was excited about it. I got good feedback on it. People who I didn't even know really listen to me like that gave me a lot of good feedback.
Yeah.
So I was very, very happy with it. And I think, like, you know, sure, I'm not a big name, but I think that as I become bigger, people going back like, oh, man, I just listened to your first. Well, it's like, that's what's wrong with the game, man. Everybody's just promoting these agencies, these managers, just promoting their clients, not based on talent, but what they are able to sell. And so I didn't have that. I didn't have that kind of rah-rah behind me. But people, when they do listen to the album, they're like, oh. Because people are like, how could somebody be funny if I don't know who they are? If they're not famous, how is that possible? But it's very much possible. It depends on who behind you.
As sad as that is a very common statement you hear as well.
Yeah. I do want to shout out a serious comedy website. They wrote me a great review.
That's awesome.
And they were very, very nice about it. All these other websites can kick rocks.
I'm always honest no matter what, and I liked your album.
Thank you,
But there's one thing that I didn't like, and it wasn't you. It was your crowd.
You didn't like the crowd?
I did not like the crowd. I thought they were... So I shot a comedy special. I'll show you after this. And same thing. That's why I'm wondering how many takes did you do? Did you do one show?
I did two shows.
Two shows? Okay.
I did an 8 o'clock show and a 10 o'clock show.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it was, we were running the show every Sunday at the Knitting Factory,
mm-hmm.
and the show was always at 9, and it was free.
Gotcha.
I did an 8 o'clock show and a 10 o'clock show
mm-hmm.
that was, I think, $12 or $15.
Mm-hmm.
So people may have been a little like, and we did it in the back room instead of the front where it usually is, so people may have been a little taken aback about what was going on, but I liked it, especially like, and maybe I was just thinking about, like you said, I was thinking about me and how I told the joke. I was very happy with the way that I performed the mm-hmm. material. So, like, once again, you listening to it, and you're like, oh, that's funny. You're like, why aren't other people, who cares?
No.
You know what I'm saying?
No.
It's just, I'm not saying that you are at fault for that. I'm saying, that's just what we do as an audience.
Of course.
We're like, more people should be laughing at this thing.
Yes.
And that affects... That takes our head somewhere to a certain space.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a natural human thing, though, you know?
But at the same time, like, the jokes... Because remember what you talked about earlier is that at comedy shows, some people forget to laugh
or are scared
to laugh.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, I never looked at it that way. I know you're right on that. I never personally looked at it that way because if I'm at a show... If I find it funny, I laugh. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? If I'm listening to it on my Spotify or whatever, I laugh.
Absolutely.
And so listening to your album, I block out who I hear.
Right.
I'm listening to the jokes, and the jokes were hilarious, man. I dig that.
Thank you so much.
But, you know, being you know, that guy who, what you just said, is like, this guy's funny. Why aren't you?
Yeah.
And it's not that. Yeah. No. So it's not that there were missed punchlines by the audience, not by a long shot. It's just that I would hear like three voices instead of like whatever. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting too, the dynamics of, I think, like hopefully on my next album,
mm-hmm.
because I really present comedy. I don't know if you heard this in listening to it. It's very conversational.
No, definitely.
Whereas like going to that scientific thing, people like, all right, every 2.5 minutes, there's a laugh. So, like, they're not even listening necessarily. Their brain has just adapted and said, ooh.
Ghost stories.
But, yeah, your brain goes, all right, this is when I laugh. And the comic knows that, so they set up their jokes to every 2.5 minutes the punchline.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People just kind of get used to that. Where mine is, I was mixing some old with some new. Mm-hmm. So you really had to be in it to catch. And sometimes they laughed unintentionally, when I wasn't even...
They didn't laugh. So I did notice that sometimes the setup is getting the laughs.
Yeah.
And it's just very... You know, I'm like, it's funny, but it's just like, it's not... I guess you can't say that there's an educated audience, because everyone's always different.
Yeah.
But there's just moments where you're like, okay.
There's some cerebral stuff in there, too. Like, I know that day I wasn't feeling my best. Physically, I had been going through it. Like, I had been moving back and forth. There was a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say from a performance, not necessarily from a writing perspective, from a performance, I would say I legged out a triple.
Mm-hmm.
For non-baseball people, a triple is the most exciting play in baseball. And you really have to hustle to get a triple, because a lot of things have to go in the right direction.
Yeah.
But, and a lot of times a double is easy, but to take that triple is daring. So we should all be going for that. But, and it was just a lot. But I had the first show was very set up punchline, like very kind of straight to it. This is stand-up in its, like, purest form. This 10 o'clock show, I was drunk as a skunk. So, in the edit is a mixture of those two shows.
Of course.
Because I didn't want a whole thing where I sounded like a history teacher. On the more serious jokes, I probably went with the 10 o'clock take.
Sure.
Just because I was looser there.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel it, but I mean, like I said, in the end, it was a good album to listen to, and I hope everyone who's listening does listen to the album.
You mean first of all on iTunes, Spotify,
and oh snap,
all the streaming services
by everywhere. Park Jones. Everywhere.
You know the dope part on my Instagram stories when I put music, I can put myself.
That's cool.
That's very cool.
That is cool.
Say I'm doing like the show I'm doing tonight in the music sound bed. I put one of my jokes. An album.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. What's your preparation like for a show? I mean, obviously, you don't have like we mentioned, you just kind of go out mm-hmm. there with adrenaline. But as far as like now, since you just did your special, mm-hmm. do you have, you'd say, like a prepared 15, 20, or are you back to an hour already?
There's some material that I'm working on now that I always do, like a 10 that I'm working on now.
Okay.
That I want to expand, that I've been, because I want to do another album this year.
Okay.
But I think about my material all day.
Of course,
you have to. All day I think about my material. So ideally, it intensifies when I'm showering for a show and gets even more intense on the drive up. Ideally, my process is to walk off the street and up to the stage. That's the most ideal situation
for
me.
Like no one to say, just say things to scramble your
hey, how you doing? Yeah. I can do all that after I get off. Ideally, it would be that, but that doesn't always happen. Sometimes I sit in the car, like I'll check in and then I'll go back to the car then, or like out of town, I just walk around and try to like feel the city or feel the neighborhood a little bit.
Sure.
But right now it's just writing and listening a lot and expanding on some of the stuff that I didn't put on the album. Because I think, first of all, it was 56 minutes, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I would say, like, brand new things, I'm, like, at 20 mm-hmm. now. So I'm trying to get that up.
I feel
45.
Like with what you were saying, you were working on some old stuff. I've had it, and I'm sure you've had it, where you might be working on something that you're like, this is the punch, this is it, and you're working so hard, it's just not working. And then after a while, you could figure out, you know what, that would have been the good setup, that part.
Right. Yeah, so there's a couple of things from the album that were jokes there mm-hmm. that worked better as a setup for something else now, like a couple quick hitters. Mm-hmm. So I got to figure out how to replace those mm-hmm. to get into the new material so I don't repeat it.
Of course, of course.
But, you know, I think it was Seinfeld, who I love, who was just talking about, like, people are paying for a show. Give them your best.
Definitely true.
I understand you got to work on new material, but give them the goods if they're paying for a show.
Exactly. Did you mention you want to do another one this year? Probably, who knows, you know, summer, fall, winter. Do you have an idea on where, or do you not think about that right now?
It depends. I'm going to be in L.A. for a while, and I like L.A. I like Atlanta. Okay. I'm going to do a little bit of touring, so whatever city really speaks to me.
Gotcha.
Chicago would be good. I'm just trying to get my weight up, man.
Just in the summer.
Summer, fall, hopefully the fall, because this one was done in September, so maybe in September again. I just want to get, you know, get my followership up so people come out for it.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? So I'm working on a couple of things. You got to do some things outside of stand-up to get people to the shows. Yeah. That's just a part of the shit.
You got
to
market, man.
No matter how much you want to resist it, you got to give them more to get them what you need. So I'm working on some things right now to try to see that.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Clark, it's been awesome chatting with you, you know, about the ins and out, man. I like to get that perspective from someone like you, you know, who's been doing it for so many years.
Thank you.
Like I said, congrats on the album, man. It's awesome, and I can't wait to see what you come up with, you know, on this next one.
Oh, yeah, it's gonna be so fulfilling because all of this is, by and large, starting from scratch again. And a lot of people, when they put out an album where they do, like, Last Comic Standing or something like that, they go, oh, you burned through your material. But it's cool because listening to it, it's almost like I'm writing for myself because I can hear myself like, oh, that's the way that I tell jokes. It's like I'm adjacent to who I am. I'm a writer for Clark Jones.
Hell yeah. You know? We're going to start wrapping it up. But yeah, tell us all your handles, man.
At the Clark Jones everywhere. Twitter, Instagram, and Snap. Yeah, just follow me on there. I post all my shows wherever I'm going to be. So you're like, are you going to be here? Just wherever I post, that's where I'm going to be at. I post everything.
And we'll all be there, man. We'll check it out. Thank you for being on, man. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pod Monster. If you like what you hear, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And follow me on Twitter and Instagram at DPhilipGood with an E at the end. See ya.